and welcome to More Than a Movie, the weekly show about films and filmmaking here on Campus FM. My name's Andrew Bonello, and along with a guest I'll be welcoming onto the show very shortly, we're taking a journey into the magical world of movies to explore why film is such a powerful reflection of real life's struggles and joys. This week, it's Flirtations with the Afterlife. Yes, one way or another, we'll delve into movies that explore the philosophy surrounding the end of life, what lies beyond, and the space in between. Films that ponder the plethora of inevitable questions raised therein. As we'll see, this is a beautiful little subgenre. Whatever your beliefs may be, the body of cinematic work tackling the afterlife rarely forces you to adopt a solid position on what lies beyond, couched in mystery and fantasy as these films commonly are. So, coming up a little later in the show, can an existential crisis be answered by a visit from another realm?
I lost a patient.
You did everything you could?
I was holding his heart in my hand when he died.
He wasn't alone.
Yes, he was.
We'll follow a sorry teenager's utterly unique high school experience.
Hey, Mom! Look at me! Smile!
My name is Salmon, like the fish.
Okay, shipmate, take it away.
First name, Susie. I was 14 years old when I was murdered.
And if you had the power to connect with the beyond, how would you use it?
You have a duty to do it because you have a gift.
It's not a gift, Billy. It's a curse.
First, though, our guest this week. John Fenech originally studied audio engineering, and between 2014 and 2016 did sound work on several films shooting here in Malta. Assassin's Creed was his first step towards the role of on-set digital imaging technician. He's now based in the UK, working as a digital imaging assistant, data manager, and video operator on some big titles shot in London and beyond. Those include Mary Poppins Returns, Pokemon Detective Pikachu, Fast and Furious 9, and even Star Wars Episode 9, The Rise of Skywalker. He's worked on set with very well-known directors, including Danny Boyle, Ridley Scott, and Guy Ritchie. And he joins me today from over in London. Hello, John, and welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you here, John. Well, listen, to get started, you've got a very impressive filmography here with some really well-known genre movies from recent years already under your belt. Can we start, though, by asking you to explain a little bit about the role of a digital imaging technician on a typical film set?
So the role of a digital imaging technician varies quite a bit from film to film, but I think the most important is he's a camera technician, so any hard questions from the director of photography gets asked to him first. And then he has to deal with the color pipeline, so the color space of the camera, and just make sure that from every step, from principal photography to that final, finishing touch at the end, which we call the grade, if all the colors line up and the DOP is happy with the finished result.
So it's a very technical role then, John, by the sound of things.
It is. You have to, it's very much 50% technical, 50% creative as well, because you have to, as a digital imaging technician, you have to deal a lot with colors and the color space and all that sort of stuff, which sometimes can be a bit subjective, but more often than not, it is objective.
Right, and do you do this typically as part of a team? Is there a group of you managing this?
So I never got to the stage of digital imaging technician. The highest I've got was the data manager, where I take care of the information. So when the camera rolls, it rolls on a magazine or a memory card. Mm-hmm. That memory card then needs to be saved onto another memory card. In fact, it has to be saved onto three memory cards, and this is because of redundancy. Mm-hmm. Because at the end of the day, if a production spends, 500,000 on one day of shooting, that 500,000 is essentially your rushes, mm-hmm. which is in these magazines, ones and zeros. So we copy them three times using specialized software, and then from then on, they are sent to the editor's lab, where they try and make sense of them, they sync sound to them, They put a primary grade on them to make them look better, so that any producer spending £500,000 knows that he's getting his money's worth. And then they go through the eventual pipeline, which culminates at the it's called the DI, which is the digital intermediate. And it's basically a fancy word for two people look at the entire film and they finesse very finely the colors to match either a creative eye or a technical requirement by Netflix or a cinema and so on and so forth.
So it sounds like, to a large extent, you're responsible for making sure that the actual data that the cameras are seeing on the film set gets stored, gets duplicated as necessary, you know, gets transferred and doesn't get lost. Is that right?
Yes, exactly. That is my role as a digital image technician was culminated at data manager. Now I find myself doing a video operator's role, which is what I call myself nowadays, essentially, which is liaising on set with directors and directors of photography. And you know, I record the image externally and I play it back at their will. Sometimes I might even do help out with a bit of VFX, just so they have an idea of what they're getting.
For example,
if there's a blue screen and there's something required on the back of that blue screen, I will put that image needed on the back and they will see if everything lines up.
Right, so in a way then, if I'm understanding right, during the filming, the director and cinematographer might pause during takes to review the shots that are coming in and make sure that, for example, as you say, they've got the effects lineup that they need. And they're communicating directly with you as the video operator to request which shots get played, which shots get combined, and so on and so forth. Is that right?
Yes, exactly. So I'm basically the technical middleman, as you would say, on set. You know, showing them, making sure that they are seeing the right cameras. Because, you know, sometimes on these big films, there can be upwards of 3 to 4 cameras. Because the more cameras you add, the idea is you save money the more cameras you add. Because you are capturing a scene in a shorter amount of time, theoretically speaking. Which was Ridley Scott's, it's what Ridley Scott is famous for. Mm-hmm. You know, he would point 3 cameras to a scene and he, you know, if a day was meant to be 10 hours, he'll get it done in 8 hours. You know, that is the value of good filmmaking. You get more for less money spent.
Interesting. But of course, as the operator, you've got to be right there on point with the director, right? Because they'll be saying, no, I don't want this take. Let's go back 3 and check this. And, you know, they'll be giving you specific sort of commands. And you've got to be right on the money with providing those shots.
Yes. And then the thing is, the beauty of my job is I'm essentially a fly on the wall for many of these directors, which is a privilege because they're not all the same. For example, Danny Boyle never used to watch playback. He used to know exactly, you know, if the take works, what it needed, and he used to do it all without reviewing 10 times, which is fascinating because it requires such a photographic memory, essentially. Because if a scene, say, is, you know, if a take is, you know, usably 10, 20 seconds long, he has to make sure that everything is good, and then he moves on. Danny Boyle used to do that without reviewing first, which is quite impressive.
So, but just to be clear, he'd typically seen the shot coming in on the viewfinder of the camera.
Yes.
Okay, so he actually...
Yes.
He verified the frame.
No, he'll watch it. Yes, he'll watch it at the monitors. So, typically on set, the director will have his own monitors. And the director of photography will have their own set of monitors, and everyone during a take will be silent, looking at the monitor, watching and reviewing.
Very interesting. Okay, so John, you've mentioned that you were on a Guy Ritchie movie crew recently, The Wrath of Man. Are you able to talk about that a little bit?
Yes. I mean, I've done a couple of works with Guy Ritchie now. It's luckily enough, it's becoming one of hopefully more of my crews, you know, because in filmmaking, you often sometimes you end up with the same crews, same people, and you get to have, you know, a bit more friendship on set.
And so how did the collaboration with Guy Ritchie initially come about, John?
It was through word of mouth. I think I was the only one available at that point because it's so busy. Yeah, so I think I was the only one available, so I had to sort of step up and do it, which I'm very glad, because working with Guy Ritchie is quite a show in itself. You know, he's your quintessential British man, mm-hmm. and everything you've ever seen of Guy Ritchie, Lockstock, Snatch, Sherlock, you know, all the classics, Rock and Roller, which is one of my favorite ones. Mm-hmm. The dialogue is all him, mm-hmm. you know, and it's just that funny, witty and visceral dialogue. And it's all him. If you see him, you meet him on set, you are meeting Snatch, you're meeting Lockstock, because that's how he is. You know, he calls people the C word. I don't know if I can say that actually, but he's very, he's funny. He's a funny man, and he knows how to direct. He knows how to direct action sequences, which is what he impressed me the most with. Because I think it was on Wrath of, I think before it was called Cash Truck, but now they've relabeled it to Wrath of Man, because I think Cash Truck was the original French title.
I see.
And on the set of Wrath of Man, he was there with his stunt coordinator, and he was offered something, and he took the element of the fight, but he made it his own. He made it more believable, more realistic, and it just made sense, you know? Because I think sometimes with fight scenes, especially there might be a bit too much flair and spectacle, but he constructed it in a way that made sense to the camera and also made sense to the audience, which was fascinating to watch.
So he's obviously a very visually aware director, but in terms of the dialogue that you mentioned that he contributes to the film, how much of that is prepared in the script? Does he improvise a lot of dialogue with his actors during the shoot, or is it all kind of set up in advance?
I think it's 50-50 sometimes. I think he's the kind of director who treats actors as if they are, you know, as if they are a crew. I think sometimes the director can treat actors like royalty, you know, untouchable. Whether Guy Ritchie puts them on a more human footing, I thought, which is quite interesting to see, and it obviously works for his what he's trying to achieve. What was the question again? Sorry. Oh, the improvisation. Yes, I mean, a lot of it he allows the actor to improvise. You know, he does give that creative leeway to actors, where in the spare of the moment he would let them say something, and if it works, it works. But if it doesn't, he's going to call them out on it.
Okay.
Which brings me back to the, you know, on the equal footing term.
Very interesting. Okay, well, John, let's take a little bit of a change of pace here. Our theme for this week's show is flirting with the afterlife. And I wonder, do you have a movie that sort of touches on that theme that you're particularly fond of?
I mean, I've had a think about this, and it's quite a hard subject. Like that. Well, I think one of my favorite films is called Mr. Nobody.
We don't know who Mr. Nobody is. Neither does he. Our patient's memories are confused.
So, Nemo, have you made up your mind? Do you want to come with me, or do you want to stay with your father? We cannot go back. That's why it's hard to choose.
Nemo!
You have to make the right choice. As long as you don't choose, everything remains possible.
I'm sorry, I don't understand. Did you stay with your father or go with your mother?
remember.
So that's from 2009, Mr. Nobody, the drama fantasy, starring that quixotic actor Jared Leto and directed by Jacko van Dormael. So the trailer for this, John, I had a look after you had mentioned it, and it's intrigued me more than just a little bit. What did you love so much about this film?
It's hard to say. I mean, I do love that missed connections. You know, have you ever seen Cloud Atlas?
Yes, I have. Yeah.
This is the original Cloud Atlas for me, because right. It's all about missed connections and what could have been, and it touches a lot on the afterlife as well in the end, but not too much on the nose.
Right. Not explicitly.
Not explicitly, no. I mean, I can't really say without giving the ending, so I won't go into it. But no, it's just classic filmmaking. You know, it's more image than dialogue, this film.
Great. Well, thanks for that recommendation, John. We'll take us a little bit of a musical interlude now, and I've queued up a little bit of music from the soundtrack of Mr. Nobody. Let's have a listen. It's composed by Pierre van Dormael. So, John, now let's get back to the subject of your varied career on the film set production front. So you'd mentioned Danny Boyle. You also mentioned you've done some work with Ridley Scott. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I did the UK leg of All the Money in the World, which was famously, it was one of Kevin Spacey's last works.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, we did all the Kevin Spacey parts before he got replaced by Christopher Plummer. And, you know, it was pretty, I mean, Ridley Scott is one of my heroes, because I remember, I mean, Alien classic, Thelma and Louise, you know, he's just one of those greats, I think. And watching him on set and his process has sort of highlighted that, you know, because typically, you know, days on film sets are 12 hours to 10 hours long. Mm-hmm. And I mean, Ridley used to shave off 4 hours off your day, you know. I mean, the crew would be grateful because, you know, they're working less.
Yeah.
But also the producers would be grateful because they're getting, you know, they're getting the same amount of footage as they would on a regular day, which is impressive. He is very much a subtractive director, I think. At least that's what I thought. I might have obviously a one-sided impression of him because I'm there on set, so I'm not really sure what he does in pre-production, because there's, you know, a director's work is just so vast, you know, pre-production, post-production. But on set, I felt like he was a very much an armchair general, you know? He gets shown an image and then he corrects it. This is all over a radio. He would instruct the prop man to turn a chair 90 degrees using very colorful language, which Ridley Scott is, again, another very funny man, very, very British man and a very right. funny man and charismatic. And he's very much, he has to be shown something and then he will adjust it to his ways, you know?
And in terms of the saving of time on set, you mentioned a little earlier in the interview that he does that with multiple camera setups, partially.
Yes.
Is there other technique that he uses on set that contributes to that saving of time compared to other directors?
Well, he just, he knows what makes a scene thick.
Right.
Thick, sorry.
He knows what he wants, basically.
Yes. Well, he knows how a scene needs to be constructed. So primarily, directors would start with a wide, they would call it a master shot. So everything would be on the wide, and then you'd slowly go in tighter for the close-ups, you know? So that is essentially how you would, how a director would approach a scene. You do a master first, and then you'd go in tighter, with a tighter lens, and you slowly move in tighter. Ridley would try, half that process in half. So he would, to the detriment sometimes of the sound department, because they'll have to move a boom.
Right, right.
He would sometimes do a wide and a tight and a mid. I mean,
like at the same time.
Yeah, exactly. He would just get angles he would need, during. He'd throw in a camera. If he knows he's going to get that shot anyway, he would throw in a camera and try to get it. Obviously, sometimes this brilliance is obviously down to his cinematographer as well, Darius Wolski. Mm-hmm. So it is very much a team effort, filmmaking. Credit where credit is due.
And then, of course, in building on from that, if Ridley Scott and his cinematographer are putting in extra cameras in a single sort of setup of a shot, it's also relying on the technical prowess of people like yourself and the boom mic operator and all the other technicians on set to be able to work around that and give him what he needs without sort of everyone treading on each other's toes. Would that be fair?
Exactly. So you'd have to be constantly aware of what cameras are going in, what cameras are going out, and you have to work with the allotted time given, because any delays are worth thousands of pounds. Like, a second is worth a lot of money on a film set. If you were to divide the budget of a whole film and divide it per day, I think a minute on a film set would run in the hundreds of thousands.
Right. I mean, we're talking big money here for these productions.
Yes, it's very big money.
So, John, just as we come to the end of the interview here, you've worked on some really big special effects movies too, and Pokemon Detective Pikachu came up in your filmography. Can you talk a bit about some of the process and the layering that was involved in that on-set film shoot?
Yes, so Pokemon was actually one of the first big shows I was invited to join. And what impressed me the most about Pokemon was the decision for them to film on 35mm rather than digital. And at that point, I was very naive in terms of what VFX entails. But we had these very, very clever VFX departments. And basically what they had done was, they had first manufactured these very expensive like Pokemon puppets that cost tens of thousands of pounds. But they were very realistic. You look at them, you think they're alive. And now I know that this is the standard way of shooting heavy VFX laden films. What they do is there's like four passes. There's one with actors, just actors alone. So say if there's a lead actor and he's interacting with something that's not actually there, say a VFX Pokemon, it would just be the actor, and then the operator would save space for the VFX Pokemon. So they would do one like that. Then they would do another take with the actor and the man in a green morph suit holding the Pokemon. And then after they're happy with that, they would do another take with just the real life Pokemon, no actors, and then they would do a clean plate. So for one scene, they would have to do four passes, and then inevitably they would have to do, for example, the actor would have fluffed up his lines. So one of those passes would have five takes, So it's quite impressive. And then when you add on to the fact that it's all film, I would imagine it would run up quite quite a financial burden on production to obviously accustom for all these passes, but it was actually quite eye-opening, and it's yes, you know, the knowledge of how they do it has made me appreciate the art even more.
It's interesting because I come from a background doing all CG animation in DreamWorks Animation in Hollywood, and that was a very different process, of course, because you're typically not combining live elements with computer-generated elements. But you're talking here about, on Pokemon, that you've got live-action plates shot on film, not digitally, but shot on an analog film camera, which are then being brought into the digital realm to combine with all these various effects layers that you're talking about, I guess.
Yes, yes. I mean, they would have to, so basically, if you shoot anything, there's quite a lot of films that are shot on 35mm, actually. Mm. Like the most recent 007 that's not out yet, that was primarily IMAX and film cameras. But what they have to do is, so they shoot on film, and then they would have to process it at the lab, you know, expose it properly and
develop
and make a print, yeah, develop it and make a print copy. And then they need to scan that copy. And then when they scan that copy, they put it into their, you know, VFX programs, Nuke and edit. Because post-production is all, it's all digital now, you know, with Avid and Nuke.
And that's a whole other world of itself, which, you know, is hopefully something we can touch on in future shows, I think, here. John, this was really, really fascinating. Thank you so much for coming on the show. I mean, it's really interesting, I think, for our audience to get a point of view of someone who's very much on the technical side on a film set. So I want to thank you very much for being with us today, and I wish you all the best of luck with your future film work. Thanks again, John.
Thank you, Andrew. Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
You're welcome. Well then, what about movies flirting with the afterlife that were shot here in Malta? Well, this is a pretty specific subgenre, so I didn't expect my research to turn up much. But venturing way back into 1970s Italian genre cinema, I discovered 1974's Morel's Invention, a science fiction drama directed by Emidio Greco. A castaway finds himself on a strange island, but grows increasingly distressed at the sighting of inhabitants in old-fashioned clothes who ignore him, almost as though he's not even there.
L'influenza del futuro sul passato. Peccato che lei non voglia credermi e che non possiamo intenderci.
Peccato. E perché?
Well, this one is an oddity indeed. A rather intriguing premise, to say the least. I've not seen the film, but from what I saw in the trailer, there's certainly lots of nice photography, with scenes shot on the cliff tops here in Malta and possibly in Gozo as well. The film is based on the 1940 prize-winning novel L'Invention de Morel by the Argentine writer Adolfo Bioy Casares. Critical consensus seems to be that this film adaptation is remarkably faithful to that original story. Morel's character is, indeed, partly analogous to the eponymous character from H.G. Wells' classic The Island of Dr. Moreau, written back in 1896. And since this Italian film seems to have also been influenced by 1961's Last Year at Marienbad, a classic French left-bank mystery movie, which itself is now famous for its own ambiguity and surrealism, Greco's sci-fi effort here seems to be keeping fine company indeed in terms of its inspirations. Well, it must be said, the 1970s film industry here in Malta was really thriving, although many of the titles shot here from that era do seem to have been war movies. But for a nice step back in time with a more ethereal bent, then, you might want to take a look at Morel's Invention. With subtitles, of course, if you don't speak Italian.
Faustino, ho urgente bisogno di parlarti.
Non sarà così urgente.
Devo metterti sull'avviso, e so che posso farlo perché tu sei una donna diversa dalle altre.
Se tornassi nel mondo per svelare questo segreto, scambierebbero il mio racconto per l'espediente di un pazzo. Lo stesso Morel me lo impedirebbe.
Ma non volete capire. Ha registrato con la sua macchina Charlie e Charlie è morto. Ha registrato gli impiegati della ditta Schwachter e tra loro sono avvenute morti misteriose.
Well, venturing beyond Malta now, and our first movie flirting with the afterlife is Brad Silberling's 1998 fantasy drama, City of Angels. Seth, one of a flock of ethereal beings, questions his role between this world and the next when he falls in love with a mortal.
The little girl asked me if she could be an angel.
They all want wings.
I never know what to say.
Tell them the truth. Angels aren't human. We were never human.
What if I just make her a little pair of wings out of paper?
Tell her the truth.
I told her.
And? How did she take it?
She said, what good would wings be if you couldn't feel the wind on your face?
Astute film buffs amongst you will know that this film is, in fact, a remake of Wim Wenders' Wings of Desire. And Hollywood was onto a winner in basing their film on this German movie from 1987. Presented in black and white, that movie is widely regarded as a modern classic in fantasy romance cinema. It must be said, this remake, City of Angels, received a rather cooler critical reception than its Teutonic progenitor. But let's not get too far into comparisons here. Instead, today, let's take a look at City of Angels on its own merits. It updates the pre-unification Berlin setting of the original film to modern-day Los Angeles, with that title, of course, therefore serving a cute double purpose here.
Do you come here a lot?
I live here.
What do you do?
Read.
No, I mean your work.
Oh, I'm a messenger.
Oh. Well, what kind of messenger? Like a bike messenger?
No, I'm a messenger of God.
Got a message for me?
I already gave it to you.
Well, did you use my pager? Because I usually don't get my messages unless you beat me.
You've definitely been beeped.
The film stars Nicolas Cage, who, of course, we discussed back in episode 3 of the first season of our show, and that was for his role in 1987's wonderful romantic comedy Moonstruck. Here, though, Cage is on much more somber and serious form. He's joined by veteran romantic actress Meg Ryan. Yes, she of such timeless classics as When Harry Met Sally and Sleepless in Seattle. And, well, Ryan here takes on the role of a capable surgeon who enters a deep existential crisis triggered by the loss of one of her patients on the operating table.
Come on, don't do that.
He's going.
He's not going anywhere.
That doctor in the operating room, she looked right at me.
She didn't see you, Seth. She can't see you. No one can see you unless you want them to.
And if I want her to?
What do you want her to?
Hello, Maggie.
How does she know my name?
So what we initially get, then, is a charming yet portentous exchange when the angel visits the doctor for the first time. The beautiful clip that follows is just a smidge longer than our usual sound bites. It's an extended dialogue scene. Pay attention in particular, though, to the way that music is used, especially towards the end of the clip. And we'll talk more about that in just a moment. Let's listen to the clip first.
Excuse me. Are you a visitor?
Yes.
Well, visiting hours have been over since 8.
Well, why do they have that?
What?
Hours. Doesn't it help the patient to be visited?
Well, who are you visiting, Mr. Messenger?
Right now?
Yeah.
You.
I don't need a visitor.
You're not ill?
No. I'm one of the doctors here.
Are you in despair?
I lost a patient.
You did everything you could?
I was holding his heart in my hand when he died.
And he wasn't alone.
Yes, he was.
People die.
Not on my table.
People die when their bodies give out.
It's my job to keep their bodies from giving out. Or what am I doing here?
It wasn't your fault, Maggie.
I wanted him to live.
He is living. Just not the way you think.
I don't believe in that.
Some things are true whether you believe in them or not.
How did you know my name? What's yours?
Seth.
Seth. You better get out of here, Seth. The security's gonna think you're a psych patient.
Lots of lovely silences in that very meaningful exchange. And note how that musical soundtrack crescendos at the end of the scene to underscore the significance of this very simple exchange that just took place. It's a scene that's at once heartbreaking and tender, yet also ultimately brimming with hope. This for the character of the Doctor, who's deeply despondent at this point in her life. It's all rather superbly done, like a beautiful, warm blanket that surrounds her, yet it's one that's tinged with the most solemn of linings. A little side note on performance here. I've done just a little bit of screen acting, and I can barely even begin to imagine the challenge of performing a scene like the one we just heard, with all that nuance and all that natural chemistry occurring between these two very fine actors. And it's so easy, isn't it, to look down with condescension and derision on household Hollywood names such as these in these roles. But really, let's not diminish the very sophisticated work involved in serious cinematic acting. Yes, even in the mainstream. Director Silberling orchestrates a very tender story, imbuing a serious undertone to the charming chemistry that develops between our two leads.
You're an excellent doctor.
How do you know?
I have a feeling.
It's pretty flimsy evidence.
Close your eyes. It's just for a moment. What am I doing?
You're touching me.
Touch. How do you know?
Because I feel it.
You should trust that. You don't trust it enough.
Like the original, this film touches on deeply spiritual themes about the meaning of life and in faith in a modern-day world. To be sure, it gives the story the Hollywood treatment, but that's not necessarily a bad thing. We also have a nice supporting turn from Dennis Franz, who some of you may recognize from the 1990s US police drama NYPD Blue.
I can't see you, but I know you're there.
Who are you?
Nathaniel Messenger. Former celestial body, recent addition to the human race. You want proof? You can speak every language, you travel with the speed of thought,
and you're reading my mind right now.
Stop that. You're doing it.
In essence, the film is couched as a romance, but it integrates all sorts of mystical elements, creating a rather magical tableau on which to serve the story. There's nice location photography, in particular as we head to Lake Tahoe for the film's climax. I'd argue that, as mainstream Hollywood movies go, this is one of the few that really tackles serious existential themes head-on, albeit as a remake rather than via an original screenplay. Regardless, if this sounds up your alley, then clip on your best angel wings and head to the beach to watch the sunset with your closest brethren. Then sit back for the charming and really deeply moving City of Angels.
I'll wait all day just hoping for one more minute with you. I don't even know you.
What do you want to know?
Are you married?
No.
Are you homeless?
No.
Are you a drummer?
Seth knows no fear, no pain. He hears music in the sunrise, but he'd give it all up. He loves you that much.
What's that taste like?
You don't know what a pear tastes like?
I don't know what a pear tastes like to you.
A little musical interlude now, and this lovely theme is from a film we'll be discussing just a little bit later in the show. And the film from which that music was taken will be revealed very soon. Before that, though, we have Peter Jackson's 2009 fantasy thriller, The Lovely Bones. When a young girl is brutally murdered, her soul enters a purgatorial state as she watches over her grieving family and friends.
He's cute. Does he like you as much as you like him?
Grandma, would you please just drop it?
Hey, Mom! Look at me!
My name is Salmon, like the fish.
Okay, shipmate, take it away.
First name, Susie.
Bye, Dad.
Bye, Susie.
You are beautiful, Susie Salmon.
I was 14 years old when I was murdered.
Peter Jackson needs no introduction amongst genre movie fans. He helmed the hugely successful Lord of the Rings and Hobbit trilogies, and his 2005 King Kong remake was also a big hit. Well, back in his native New Zealand, Jackson was an audacious B-movie comedy horror director before hitting the Hollywood big time. Check out 1987's Bad Taste and 1992's Dead Alive, also known as Brain Dead, for hilariously twisted gore-fest comedy horror antics. They're not for the faint of heart, though. Jackson also directed the 1994 drama Heavenly Creatures early in his career. That was a challenging but undoubtedly effective drama starring a young Kate Winslet. Here with The Lovely Bones, though, Jackson treads altogether more serious territory with a screenplay that he and his co-writers adapted from Alice Sebold's very popular novel of the same name.
I have to go.
I don't want you to leave.
I'm not going to hurt you, Susie.
A strong cast includes Mark Wahlberg, Rachel Weisz, and Susan Sarandon, all supporting a fine leading turn from then still very young Irish actress Saoirse Ronan. This is a dark tale, yet the intriguing aspect of the film is how Jackson imbues our protagonist's tragic journey towards the afterlife with very magical overtones. The late critic Roger Ebert, in his review, famously described this movie as a deplorable film. Respectfully, I have to disagree, though the film does arguably serve up a controversial take on the afterlife. It also employs a mishmash of tonal shifts and contrasting visual styles that perhaps doesn't always quite work. It's hard to deny, though, the lyrical beauty achieved at various moments in Peter Jackson's film.
You miss her, don't you?
She's gone.
What if she isn't? What if she's still here?
Grandma. Susie's in the in-between.
I wasn't gone. I was alive in my own perfect world. But in my heart, I knew it wasn't perfect. My murderer still haunted me.
The Lovely Bones, despite, or maybe even because of its whimsical tangents, makes a sincere, if not literal, attempt to portray the afterlife. It's very disturbing in places, and the film's ultimate success as a dramatic narrative is arguably in the eye of the beholder. Have you tired of Peter Jackson's big bucks monster-laden blockbusters? If so, I do recommend the intriguing and mystical genre blend that is The Lovely Bones.
Gentlemen, Glenn.
Susie would never go off with a stranger. It had to be someone she knew.
I've got a name for you.
This is police work. This is what we do.
My father had the pieces, but he couldn't make them fit.
You have a tomb in the middle of your house.
I waited for justice, but justice did not come.
You're a seven girl, right?
There's definitely something wrong with this guy.
Why won't you listen to him?
Because you need evidence. You need proof.
Well, we played a little musical interlude just a short while ago. That was from our next film, which steps forward just 1 year to 2010, for Clint Eastwood's romantic drama, Hereafter. It tells three interwoven stories about different people, worlds apart, who are each touched by death in their own special way.
Give me your hands. I don't even do this anymore.
Here, our lead is Oscar winner Matt Damon, who plays the role of a reluctant psychic, inevitably drawn back into using his gift to try and help people who want to contact loved ones in the deep beyond.
Do you have a question?
The job I had before was as a psychic.
Do the work and you'll go far.
What do you think happens when we die?
Send a hope upon a worry.
I recognize you. You're that psychic.
I have news for you. I don't do it anymore.
Die and wish before the grave.
I give you my word. I won't tell anyone.
You have a duty to do it because you have a gift.
It's not a gift, Billy. It's a curse.
This is a challenging triple narrative, yet it's pretty seamlessly handled. Eastwood, of course, featured in our last episode when we discussed his classic 90s western, Unforgiven. Well, here, Clint really demonstrates his genre proficiency, taking on the lofty themes of near-death experience, soul-searching, and grief. The story thread about a charming French journalist is particularly poignant here. There are heartbreaking and indeed heart-stopping sequences to behold, including a vividly rendered natural disaster that will literally leave you gasping for breath.
I think you experienced death.
As you'll know if you've listened to previous episodes, I'm staying light on plot details here, but boy oh boy if this isn't a skillfully put together genre drama. It's all composed into a very sincere and heartfelt study of human loss. It's one which, if you've any interest in the afterlife at all, you really ought to check out.
Listen, everything I have, I lost!
If you're worried about being on your own, don't be. You're not.
And before our final film for today, then, let's enjoy just a little more music from the soundtrack of Hereafter. This is music which, indeed, was again composed by Clint Eastwood. Finally for today, then, we move up to 2017's Before I Fall. Samantha begins just another day in her charmed life, until it turns out to be her last.
Maybe for you there's a tomorrow. Maybe there's 1,000 or 10. But for some of us, there's only today.
Hey, sexy.
Get in!
Over.
Well, Rye Russo-Young directs this mystery fantasy adaptation of a novel of the same name by Lauren Oliver. Now, I won't lie, as you might have heard in that clip from the trailer, the film opens with our young protagonist heading to school with her merry band of buddies. Girls and boys alike in this film are all living a very comfortable, privileged American high school life. And frankly, their behavior in this opening act is so spoiled and so just plain bratty that I was strongly tempted to turn this film off a few minutes in. I hesitated, though. It felt like the filmmakers might just be exaggerating these youngsters' behavior on purpose for narrative reasons. And, well, for one sweet moment in my otherwise error-strewn life, I was proven absolutely correct.
Mommy says you have to get up.
It's Saturday. Maybe for you there's a tomorrow. What happened last night?
What are you talking about?
Seriously? So funny.
I've been having deja vu all day long.
It's all high school things. Just a blip.
The film's nicely shot, with the color grading imbuing the damp Pacific Northwestern setting with a dull, desaturated look. Oliver's book technically falls into the young adult category, and that does show in both story and characterization terms here. That said, I have to admit that I was impressed at how well this story pivots into a sincere philosophical rumination, even pulling in elements that probably place it in fantasy territory.
What are you doing?
What happened last night?
What are you talking about?
I've been having deja vu all day long.
Are you okay?
It wasn't a dream. It really happened. Again.
Well, this is undoubtedly the kind of movie that could very easily fall into the melodramatic teen dramedy wastepaper basket. It certainly does not, though, as it's anchored by a tremendously accomplished performance by lead actress Zoe Deutsch. She already has an impressive list of roles in both TV and film, and I can see why. Yes, that same protagonist, swanning around in her friend's luxury SUV at the start of the film, transforms into a deeply relatable character through some very heartfelt and convincing acting. Fine work indeed for an actress who was in her early 20s when she performed in this film.
Regardless of anything I do or say, the day starts and ends the same.
My mom's going out of town.
Out of town and you're having a party?
Yeah, how'd you know?
Rob?
What?
I'm freaking out.
Are you in trouble? You can trust me.
Mom? Do you think I'm a good person?
It doesn't matter what I think.
It's important is what you think.
To be fair, all the performances in the movie are good, despite the story's unmistakable young adult underpinnings. And you may ask of this humble radio presenter, what exactly, Andrew, do you have in common with teenage girls from the northwestern United States? Well, not a lot, is my answer, or so I thought. Yes, that's right, I'm stepping out of my comfort zone with this movie, but so should you. Give it a shot for that very powerful central performance, and also for a modern spin on a story mechanic we've seen in countless predecessors, including 1993's classic Bill Murray comedy, Groundhog Day. But let's come full circle now to the afterlife once again, as we conclude. Here in Before I Fall, that time loop mechanic is intriguingly suggested as a metaphor for reincarnation. But don't just take it from me. Watch the film, decide for yourself, and then send me an email.
I had to do something that would make a difference. Maybe things could change. And maybe I could change them. It's never too late.
Are you in trouble? You can trust me.
Trust me back. Maybe for you there's a tomorrow, but for some of us, there's only today. But I didn't know any of that until right before I fell.
So, what did you think of the movie selection in our show today? For that, and any other feedback, suggestions, and questions, please email us at morethanamovieqs@gmail.com. That's morethanamovieqs, all one word, @gmail.com. This More Than a Movie episode was written and presented by me, Andrew Bonello. A big thanks to our guest, John Fenwick, for joining us today, and also, of course, to our immortal sound engineer, Redent Abdillah. The intro music was Creepy Comedy and the outro is Inspiring Teaser, both by Raphael Crux at filmmusic.io. The clips are licensed under creativecommons.org version 4. Thanks so much for listening, and I do hope you'll join us again next week for another episode of More Than a Movie.